Welcome to DevelopLex, a Middle Tech production hosted by me, Weston Lockhart, Ross Bogus, and Evan Knowles. This series will focus on the ins and outs of real estate development and investing, where we'll have the opportunity to sit down with developers of our cities, veterans of the industry, and key people that have over time made a massive impact on communities and neighborhoods. The purpose of this series is to be able to bring a knowledge base to our audience beyond that of what reading a book or watching a how-to video ever could, and educate from those who have done it by hearing their stories, both good and bad, along the way. We feel that historically the learnings of real estate have been inaccessible without being connected, and we would love to open the doors to the next generation of doers, as well as shine a light on how visions of community have been brought to life. We hope you enjoy. Before diving in, we'll get a quick word from our sponsors. DevelopLex is sponsored by SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate, a full-service commercial real estate firm located in Lexington, Kentucky, affiliated with the SVN International Network, which is comprised of over 1,600 advisors and staff and 200-plus offices across the globe. The SVN Stone team consists of experienced commercial real estate advisors in the heart of the Bluegrass. SVN provides commercial real estate services to large corporations, middle-market businesses, and individual entrepreneurial investors. Serving the greater Lexington area, SVN offers advisory services for sales, leasing, management, and development of commercial properties locally, regionally, and nationally. With transaction volume of over $400 million, the advisors at SVN Stone Commercial Real Estate have vast experience and deep understanding of all aspects of commercial real estate.
DevelopLex is sponsored by Rapid Fire Investments. Rapid Fire Investments provides access to off-market, distressed, and discounted real estate opportunities in the Central Kentucky area. If you're an investor or looking to invest in Central Kentucky, check out their website at rapidfireinvestments.com to see a list of their available deals.
We are also sponsored by Community Trust Bank. Community Trust offers a wide variety of home loans, commercial loans, and small business loans to suit your financial needs, as well as mobile banking, internet banking, and bill pay. Their friendly and professional staff would love to assist you at one of their 6 Lexington locations. Community Trust Bank is committed to building communities built on trust. Member FDIC, equal housing lender, subject to credit approval.
Welcome back, guys. This is Ross Bogus and Adam Edlin for this week on DevelopLex. We have a really exciting episode, and I think you all will learn a lot ahead of what we're going to talk about. And Adam, we're just so excited that...
Man, I'm excited to be with you. I'm a fan of the show, and I'm a big believer of what you and Weston are doing here, and it's an exciting time to be in Lexington. A lot of good things going on because a lot of good people are making stuff happen. So let's celebrate that.
And celebrate you. You're one of the big people that, man, I admire what you do and everything that you really get to do for the state.
It's pretty cool, man. I mean, I'm one of these folks who has lost more in life than he's won, right? But I have this thing about me. I guess it's being a farmer's kid. You learn humility early. So getting knocked down, once you've been knocked down a bunch of times, it just becomes part of the journey, right? So, I joke that as bad as my timing was, I think, in politics, I've kind of been rewarded in this moment as an entrepreneur and having a blast in a town I love.
That's awesome. Well, let's talk about the farm kid life and where you're from, yep. How you got into what you do. And
yeah, so it's really, I don't know if it's interesting to anybody else, but I think it's a pretty uniquely Kentucky story, right? You know, my family has farmed in Kentucky for 150 years, and I don't mean like racehorses and high-end cattle. I mean corn, wheat, soybeans. I grew up in the tobacco patch in Meade County, Kentucky. My dad still farms. My mom had me at 16, and, you know, if you believe in the old school approach, nothing in life would have predicted I've ended up where I am based on where I came from, except I had parents who skinned their knuckles to make sure I had every opportunity. And both my folks are workaholics. And so I know, you know, in the culture we're in, everything's about work-life balance and you know, quality of life. I am my work and I love it and it's my passion. And you know, I think a lot of that was born from being a farmer's kid. I mean, being independent is in my DNA. Farmers work for themselves. I am much better as an entrepreneur than I ever was as an employee. But I had a lot of great experiences over my life that I think prepared me to hopefully be a meaningful, impactful leader. And whether I've tried to do that, whether I was in the public sector or in the private sector.
Well, that is cool. So hit two different things I'd love to unpack is the entrepreneurial, which farming is very entrepreneurial.
It can be pressing and unique, but it's I think there's something about those who are raised by farmers when you understand that there are elements to this world that you just can't affect, right? I mean, asked my dad several years ago, I said, Dad, do you believe in climate change? He said, hell yes, son, I live in it. And I think that reality toughens you up a bit. And so, you know, again, I've been knocked down a lot in this lifetime, but you know, every time I've gotten myself up and you know, things are good as a result, I think.
Yeah, I think Paul Harvey said it best that when there's problems, so God made a farmer.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting you bring up Paul Harvey because a lot of folks who didn't grow up in a farm culture don't understand how important, you know, current events are to farmers because farmers talk about, you know, three things. They talk about the weather. They talk about in Kentucky sports, basketball in particular, and they always talk about politics. So I grew up in an environment where, you know, everybody read the newspaper in my family. The Courier-Journal came every single day, and you would come in for lunch or what we called dinner back then, and you listened to Paul Harvey. And then, you know, I got to watch really smart people argue back and forth about current events, and it facilitated a love of policy and politics and public service, and that's where my interest in public life and government really sprung from watching my grandfather and my dad, my great uncles and my grandmother arguing about politics in the kitchen of an old farmhouse or in the stripping room of a tobacco barn.
Yeah. So in between growing up and getting into politics, fill us in of where you went to school and...
Yeah, so my folks divorced when I was young, and as is the want and tradition of very young women in small-town America, they tend to move to the largest city, and my mother did. And so she moved to Louisville, and I bounced back and forth between Meade County and Louisville, and I went to St. X and got a terrific education and got involved in debate and got involved. I wasn't, you know, listen, I played baseball in Meade County until I was 15. I was not good enough to play for St. X's baseball team, as you can imagine. So I got interested in debate. And there was an awesome program in Kentucky put on by the Kentucky Youth Association, the YMCA, KYA, the Kentucky Youth Assembly. And I got elected governor as a junior of KYA and literally made friends all across the state. And that really was the pivotal moment in my adolescence because I got to be youth governor. I made friends all over the state. I was well known as a freshman coming on campus at UK because there were thousands of kids in that program. And I think it's even gotten larger. But Paul Patton was the lieutenant governor at the time that I was youth governor, and he and I hit it off, and he offered me a job. And so I spent early part of college working part-time in the lieutenant governor's office and as a full-time student. And when he ran for governor, that transitioned. I became more of a full-time employee and finished up UK at night. And then he was elected governor in the closest election in the history of the state until the Bashir Bevin race. And became a, you know, I was an aide to the governor at 20, about right before I turned 21. And it was a great experience. Well, I got lucky, right? I mean, I worked my tail off, but, you know, we won by 24,000 votes out of a million cast. I mean, it was really fortunate. And I made the most of that opportunity for the next few years.
That's incredible. That's incredible. So public service and then transition to private sector.
I spent the first, I worked for Governor Patton. I really traveled with him almost every day for most of his first term. But I knew, you know, one, he was going to get reelected. And two, I learned as much as I could. But I think what made Paul Patton, particularly in that first term, such a successful governor is that he had a background in the private sector as an engineer, as a coal operator, as an entrepreneur himself that really prepared him for public life. And so he was always in my ear about not going to law school. And I don't mean that to insult your lawyers who listen to this show, but we know, well, let's just put it this way. I am constitutionally more focused on outcome than process. And sometimes that gets me in trouble, but it means I have like five lawyers who are all smiling as they listen to this. So I knew I wanted to learn more about business, right? I had not been around a lot of entrepreneurs. As you admit, you know, farming is entrepreneurial, but I never really understood or appreciated business other than to respect the businessmen and women that I was around. And so I got a job as the vice president of operations at the Lexington Chamber of Commerce. And I got to be part and parcel of working around some really terrific business people who were focused on making the community better. And so learned a lot about business and had a great time with that and was lured away to work at Thomas & King, which at the time was a $300 million real estate and restaurant company right here in downtown Lexington that employed, gosh, thousands of people and from Boardman, Ohio to Chandler, Arizona. It was really a great company. And I learned a ton there. I learned a lot about what to do and candidly, you know, some about what not to do. But it was a great experience. And I fell deeply in love with the private sector and with entrepreneurs because, as you know, I'm an energetic guy who likes to get stuff done. I think entrepreneurs really are better suited for public life and for impacting government than they think. Some of my best friends are lawyers. I don't mean to quit to keep picking on them. But when you've got government that seems to be dominated by lawyers who are trained to make arguments, who are trained to follow a process, that is all well and good. And it's absolutely vital to running a good business and running good government. But you have to have the impatient entrepreneurial personality better engaged in the public sphere, because if not, nothing will happen. I mean, you've got to have change agents and innovators and disruptors who are driving reform and modernization. And I firmly believe we need more business people in public life, whether it's running or serving in appointed positions. It's just a different level of intensity and patience, and in this case, impatience. And I think that's really what we need more of in the public sphere. And you find it in abundance in the private sector.
Yeah. And that is so cool that now you get to jump into some renewable energy development.
Man,
and take that exact energy.
It's wild, right? Because it is, you know, we have in Kentucky a political culture that doesn't exactly reward innovation. I mean, this is a place where we like older names and we like comfortable ideas. And that's because the history of Kentucky, a lot of the history of Kentucky is exploitation from the outside, right? I get it. I mean, you know, whether it was the $1 trillion worth of coal wealth that was exported from Kentucky without leaving enough behind for the benefit of communities, whether it's the, you know, the tobacco farmers who were abused for a very long number of years by the tobacco monopolies, you know, that's the culture. I get it. Maybe one that I'm not ideally suited for. And so what I love about running my company, Edlin Renewables, is we're dynamic and we're nimble. And if we want to turn on a dime, we can turn on a dime. And so, you know, we began with this belief that we could repurpose old mine sites for utility scale solar. And it took years to prove that the concept would work. And we've got our first project in Martin County, Kentucky, that will be going to construction soon. Folks, pray that the supply chain crisis gets resolved, because it's holding up a lot of good things in many different areas. But we're working hard to make sure this doesn't meaningfully delay our project. But, you know, we get to be innovators. And so, you know, if I have advice for any listener or younger entrepreneur, listen to people smarter than you. I have a mentor named David Absher, who is the head of sustainability, who's a sustainability lead for Toyota. David was one of the architects of Toyota's groundbreaking commitment to being 100% renewably powered. And they did this 6 or 7 years ago. They were the largest heavy manufacturer on the planet to say, no, we're going to commit to net zero, to carbon, to being carbon free. And the guy who wrote that is from Letcher County, Kentucky, originally, and his first job was in the coal mines. Now, if that isn't proof positive about what a great country this is, then I don't know what is. And you ask David what he does, and he says, well, I wake up in the morning and I marshal the resources of the largest automotive manufacturer on the planet to fight climate change. And so listening to him interact with developers much larger than mine, my company, and his frustration that not enough of these developers were thinking creatively about how to leverage these enormous private investments for the benefit of the communities where they're developing. Because the old model was sort of a set it and forget it approach, right? You used out of town labor, you put these things together, you negotiated a tax rate as low as you can, and then you got out. And so we have a different approach. And our approach to developing is called social impact solar. And this is a process where we take primarily brownfield sites, repurpose them for relevance to the green energy economy, but utilize an approach that maximizes the local benefit, right? So it's about maximizing local employment. It's about getting those workers into human infrastructure that where they can earn an academic and or skills credential so they can be relevant to the opportunities of the 21st century. It's about paying a higher than average local tax because you want to demonstrate that green energy can help drive tax revenues in forgotten places. And the net result has been our company has blown up. And now we're involved with developing 19 projects in 11 states. You know, I'm glad your listeners can't see me because, as you know, I look very tired right now. And it's because I've been to West Virginia, Georgia, D.C., and all over Kentucky this week. But it's been a big week for us. So we're happy to do that. I'm going to collapse after this, after our podcast interview here, pal. But it's such a fascinating time to be in this space because the transition to green energy is real. It is irreversible. It is a market force. And it's never going to change. I mean, this is your generation and the one before you, the millennials, are the largest generation in American history. And even the Republican kids believe in climate change. It's a settled matter of fact for your generation in a way that it's not for the generation older than mine. And so this is the reason why the private sector is leading the fight against climate change. It's the reason why when you turn on the television at night, you see Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google, Anheuser-Busch, Toyota, Ford, General Motors, Walmart, all announcing commitments within the next handful of years to being 100% renewably powered, right? That's happening for two reasons. The second reason is that these companies know that there's no point in doing business on a planet that's on fire. The real driver is that your generation and the millennials are the largest collective part of the population in American history. You're far bigger than the boomers, and you're driving market behavior. And the truth of the matter is that your generation isn't going to buy a Camry from Toyota or a chicken sandwich from a fast food restaurant that doesn't have a sustainability commitment. And so what's fascinating about this, on the day where the Inflation Reduction Act is going to pass, which is the most profound climate bill taken by a government in the history of this planet. And this is a historic moment, whether you agree with it or not. But the fact of the matter is that when Donald Trump took us out of the Paris Accords, the Fortune 500 just shrugged their shoulders and said, no, we're good. We're going to stay in. And it's a reaction to the younger generation that is now dominating the consumer market, who understand that their purchasing power is also a value statement. And so I can tell you the planet is literally being saved because 30-year-olds value sustainability. And that's a market force, not a government force. And it's extraordinary to be part of this wave.
That is absolutely incredible to listen to how you're doing that with purpose. And I've seen it where just with your staff, there's a gentleman that is focused on doing the right thing for the community with the workforce.
Absolutely. We've got a head of workforce solutions who we drop on the, you know, I had this concept that we can take these tremendous, I mean, these are huge capital investments. The Martin County investment is $231 million private capital investment on 2,000 acres of a mountaintop removal site at one of the most famous mines in the history of Appalachia. You know, we're going to put back to work 250 to 300 out of work miners and other locals or folks who've been displaced by the disappearance of that coal economy. They'll earn an academic skills credential that's portable, and we're going to get them into workforce development infrastructure that says, okay, you want to go work on another solar site? Good. We've got another one coming up, you know, 50 miles away. Or we can get you in the skilled trades with partnering with chambers of commerce or community colleges or labor unions. I mean, we are nowhere near as divided as a people as we're being led to believe. And so when you get smart motivated people together who understand that we don't have to agree on everything to work together on something. That's the magic of this leadership moment. And what's terrific about conscious capitalism, what's terrific about your generation weaponizing capitalism to fight climate change, is that it's created market opportunities to do the right thing. And so when I hear politicians, you know, talking about woke corporations and their commitments to ESG, guys, that's the new form of capitalism. And you know, the folks who don't believe in that have lost the argument, because your generation absolutely believes that business needs to be profitable, but also make the world a better place.
Well, that is so true. And man, that's cool to see how you're taking what the government could be doing and doing it yourself.
Yeah, and making a profit. I mean, we're having an unbelievable year. We're doing well while doing good. I just think that's a better path.
So walk through some of the listeners that may not be familiar enough with solar and what the scale of that looks like in terms of acreage or output, or give a little context to what that looks like from, say, site selection all the way to...
So my firm does everything from originate these projects, you know, work with land agents and other people to put together parcels of land large enough to do these projects. You know, we market them. We are a part of the team that pursues finding someone to buy the power. We are, we deal with financiers all the time. And so for the utility scale projects that we're doing, particularly on brownfields, because I think we've got to get beyond the fight over agricultural lands, but particularly on old industrial brownfields, we need at least 600 acres of gently sloping or flat land. We need proximate access to quality infrastructure. So a good road or a rail system is important. And then what's also critical is access to high quality, high capacity transmission lines, right? Because you've got to wheel this power onto the grid, which means you got to be close to existing transmission infrastructure. And one of the things that we found that was fascinating that we sort of lucked into, I mean, I've got to, you know, I'd rather be lucky than good. And I've been lucky in this, is that the transmission infrastructure that built up in Appalachia to support the coal industry, and it took a hell of a lot of power to power a coal mine, but that transmission infrastructure that built up to support the industry doesn't have anything on it anymore, but it's still there. And so we can repurpose that infrastructure to carry renewably generated power from old fossil fuel communities onto the grid and carry it to where people live. And that's really exciting.
That is incredible.
Yeah, but it's one of those things, and you know, because it's far more experience to develop on a mine site or a brownfield, there are geotechnical challenges, there are environmental remediation issues that have to be dealt with. But one of the things we lucked into is that there is, you know, in Martin County, Kentucky, literally where President Lyndon Johnson launched the war on poverty, you have transmission, electrical transmission infrastructure that is the equivalent of the 10-lane highway that runs through the middle of downtown Atlanta. You know what I'm talking about? And so that's the equivalent. So we can use that to, and we're in the energy grid that we're on connects the mid-Atlantic states and much of the Northeast with the Midwest and the Upper South. And so it's one of the few markets in the world, energy markets, that has more demand than supply. And so we're committed to supplying as much green energy to meet the demand as we can.
Well, that is incredible to hear more and more and more about what you're doing. When you're looking at Martin County or any of the Appalachian communities, besides just the infrastructure, what else is it that's driving that location?
It's the economic desperation of these communities, right? And so you can either, and this is why I believe in an ESG commitment from business, you can either exploit that need, or you can develop a win-win approach to help people, you know. And so that's the approach we have employed. I mean, we're paying a much higher than average wage in the region. We have done literally thousands of hours of work to make sure that the partnerships are in place, to ensure that the people who literally powered the industrial development of this country for 100 years, our miners, they shouldn't be thrown out just because the economy has transitioned. But rather than giving speeches about war on coal or trying to sell people their yesterdays, we got to do the hard work of building a better tomorrow. And that's what we've done with and listen to really smart people who say, you need to do it this way. We need to expand opportunity. We need to help folks envision for themselves a future in the greener, more sustainable economy, because it's not going away. I mean, this is a precondition for modern economic development, and I wish our elected leadership would do a better job of connecting the dots. I mean, man, we've got, you know, we're all excited about Ford's battery factory coming to E-Town, not far from where I spent a lot of time growing up. That plant has to be 100% renewably powered on day one of operation. That's a non-negotiable. It's the same for their plant that they're building in West Tennessee. You know, did climate change play a role in the storm that just happened? I'm not a meteorologist. I don't know for sure. But what I do know is that Eastern Kentucky has now had two individual 100-year floods in the last 2 years. And so what we know is that climate change makes the weather more severe. And so we have climate refugees now in Eastern Kentucky and Western Kentucky. I mean, the tornado that hit Western Kentucky came in December. The flash flooding that happened in July. This isn't, you know, the flash flooding wasn't a result of, you know, a particularly wet spring or snow melt. It was incredible cloudburst occurring in a very short period of time in July. This is unusual. And so what I think our elected leadership needs to do is help connect the dots, right? You know, if you want modern economic development, like the Ford plant, which is a huge deal, maybe the most important economic development announcement in Kentucky since Toyota. It cannot be overstated how historic it is. But part of that deal is they're going to be 100% renewably powered, because they're not going to use fossil fuels to power a plant that's making batteries for electric vehicles.
And what's the best way to visualize when talking about water? It's easy to say, well, water's pulled from Kentucky River, gone here. Electricity is...
Well, our existing grid is a cluster. And so for anybody who comes to talk to me about renewable energy, and when you and I meet next week, I'm going to recommend a book to you. But everybody needs to read the book. It's called The Grid. It was written by a lady named Gretchen Bakke. And I know this sounds incredibly dull, but it's not. She starts by tracing the advent of electricity and its use in the competition between Tesla and Edison, about how that evolved into the grid that we've got that was just people in communities throwing up electric infrastructure in order to meet their needs as we moved from, you know, whale oil lamps to, you know, lights. And then talks about what a mess our existing infrastructure. It wasn't too many years ago that a squirrel in Ohio brought down the grid for 2/3 of the eastern seaboard. I mean, it is a cluster. And then she paints a picture of what the grid's going to look like in the future. And it will be highly resilient. It'll be about democratizing power production. In just a handful of years, you will have a home that is retrofitted to communicate with the grid in a way that charges your electric vehicle when it's most impactful to your bottom line, when you get the cheapest energy rates and best for the planet. You'll have a knob in your house that will communicate with your washer, dryer, and your dishwasher to come on at certain hours of the day when power is more abundant or cheaper. And this is what it's going to look like. And so the infrastructure bill, the bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed several months ago, it has billions and billions and billions of dollars for grid modernization. We need that. We have to modernize our economy. This is the equivalent to when President Eisenhower very wisely built the interstate system across this country in the 50s. What we're doing with grid modernization is building a cleaner, more resilient grid that helps power the economy of the future rather than hold it behind. And so that's a big deal. But most of the country is divided into regional energy grids. We happen to be in the PJM, which stands for Pennsylvania, Jersey, and Maryland. It extends from just the New York-Pennsylvania line down through the mid-Atlantic states into Virginia, cuts across eastern Kentucky and central Kentucky on its way to Chicago. And so this is a huge energy grid, and it really is where there's so much green energy coming on it that it's created a real backup in the ability to develop projects and delays. So, you know, getting important government bodies to make sure the PJM and other grid operators have the resources they need to be able to meet the green energy demand is critical to this country hitting its climate goals and modernizing its economy. But read the book. I tell everybody, if you think it's boring, I'll buy it from you. And I have bought probably 35 copies of this book and haven't had a single person tell me they didn't like it yet.
That I will add that to our
Yeah, man. Our absolutely.
List. If you don't like it, I'll buy it back from you.
Deal. I love that. So Lexington is so lucky to have you as a visionary that's not just pushing for the city, but for the state. Mm-hmm. Walk through what you see as the next economic development for a state. Is it we're used to have manufacturing drove what it is. It seems to be more quality of life.
It is. And so I'm glad you said quality of life, because this is we are a far cry away from the economic development approach of the last century. Let's call this the analog economic development approach, which is give me a low regulatory burden, give me a low tax rate, give me cheap labor, and give me and be really lenient on your environmental restrictions. And we're going to use that. So cheap labor, lack of regulatory oversight, and low taxes were what most southern states used to draw to create economic opportunity. And that's just it's analog, man. It's as outdated. I think the primary driver of economic development now, particularly for a community like Lexington, is quality of life. What tech companies and everybody needs to understand that almost everybody is now a tech company. Even the heavy manufacturers are so committed to tech. They want to live where they want to work, where they want to set up shop, where people want to live. The reality is, if your taxes are too low and your regulatory burden is too low, and you don't have protections for people, what you get are states that underfund education, healthcare, and the infrastructure that's vital to new economy economic opportunity. And so there's a way to marry that too. I'm not saying we need to have high taxes. I certainly wouldn't want to try to bring the tax approach from Massachusetts or New York or California to Kentucky, far from it. But you're never going to build the economy of the future if you're not producing the employees who are skilled to seize the economy of the opportunities of the future. And that means fully funding education. It means having a healthcare system that's reliant. It means investing in quality of life. And so while I would say a lot of Kentucky has not done that, Lexington is as good as any city in the country, I think, in terms of building quality of life. It's awesome here. And so I spend, you know, there are two ways to categorize my time. I'm either traveling or I'm hosting people here in Lexington, where we're headquartered. And it was really cool. I got a call from the mayor the other day, and she said, "Adam, I just want to tell you that it's really cool to have a renewable energy company sign across the street from City Hall, you know, on Main Street." She says, "I really just want to thank you for the vibe that communicates." I said, "Well, Mayor, thank you for helping lead a city where I can do this sort of thing." And so it's awesome here, man. Quality of life is terrific. And almost without fail, the people who I'm bringing into this community for the first time utterly fall in love with it. Because from the landscape, you know, which is the natural handiwork of the Almighty, populated by people who are committed to taking care of it, to the growing density that we're getting downtown, to the hospitality of our people. I mean, there are some rock stars in this town, you know, that I can't wait to recommend that you have on the show. I mean, you've got, you know, guys like, I don't know if you know Albert Lukongo, who is a Congolese dude who came here and set up his own clothing line. And he is absolutely crushing it. And he's utterly committed to Lexington, Kentucky. But, you know, check out Albert Couture, right? You've got my friend Todd Lanner, who has figured out how to build a company around NIL. And he's literally with Oscar in the Bahamas right now, where I think Oscar made $500,000 in 9 hours, right? You've got guys like Lincoln Brown, who, you know, founded Wild Health and is now working on I don't want to give anything away. Lincoln, if you're listening, I hope I'm not in trouble for saying this, buddy, but is literally working on a digital platform that engages people in a way that will heal our democracy. And, you know, you got guys like you and Weston who are doing amazing things. This is happening in Lexington because while we have this reputation for like aristocracy and old money, it's total BS. You know, those people moved out of Lexington in the 80s. What makes this community so freaking great is how much I think opportunity is democratized. And I don't mean to glaze over, you know, our struggles. We certainly have struggles. There are pockets of this community that are not getting the opportunities that we need to offer everybody. But man, this is a community that's doing a better job of getting it substantially right anywhere else. And, you know, man, I'm not sure that I could have built what I had been fortunate enough to build with our team anywhere else. I mean, this was, you know, we're talking before we came on here. I mean, this town does a great job of democratizing like our civic institutions. You know, I came here as an 18-year-old, didn't really know many like older people in town. And, you know, in 12, 15 years, I had chaired the board of Kentucky Educational Television. I'd chairman of the board of the Urban League. I'd chaired the fundraising, you know, the annual fundraising campaign for the United Way and for the YMCA. And I wasn't the only one. And so there are all this, that is really unique, you know, and the one thing I hate about our reputation is that people who think this is just a blue blood town where you got to be somebody's kid to get to, you know, where everybody's born on third base. That's just not true. I think we're more, far more a meritocracy than a aristocracy. And it's super cool to see what's going on. So cool. I mean, we've got just people doing amazing things here, and they need more platforms like the one that you and Weston have built to promote them, right? I mean, I'm doing pretty well. I mean, we can afford to put a big sign up, you know, on a building in downtown Lexington, and that shows the world we're doing okay, right? But what I'm more interested in is providing a platform to the folks who are where I was 15 or 20 years ago, because there's so much right with this town, and it's largely about our people.
Well, thank you. And thank you for making time for this today and what you're doing in the state and really the nation to make.
I mean, man, our footprint now extends from Pennsylvania to the timberlands of Georgia to New Mexico and Arizona to like Montana and Wyoming. And how this happened, I don't know. But we're working. I'm the dog that caught the proverbial truck. So I'm working like hell to catch up, but having a blast doing it. Absolutely having a blast doing it.
That is awesome. Well, Adam, thank you so much for the time. And I know the listeners are going to be appreciative of all the energy and just the vision that you have for the state.
Well, who can't, you know, listen, there are some folks who've gotten a bad lot in life. But if you're waking up in Lexington, Kentucky with a job, you're doing better than like 95% of the probably 99% of the population on the planet. This is a great place to live because great people want to live here. And we got to keep making that happen. And so I think so much of the work of doing this is falling on guys your age and, you know, young ladies and young men, and they're 20, you know, from 35 plus or 35 and younger are really the future. And y'all, you know, one thing I dealt with that I don't think you'll have to deal with as much is that there are a lot of people who told me to wait my turn. And maybe I should have, right? Particularly in politics, maybe I should have. But that's really bad advice to young, ambitious folks who are trying to make a difference. So it's not advice I ever give.
Well, that is great advice to not take or to.
Yeah. Oh, listen, we're as much defined by our enemies as we are our friends. We're as much defined by the advice we don't follow as that we do follow. But this is a great place. I'm telling you, anybody can make their mark here. And I personally think the next 20 years in this city are going to be mind-boggling. I'm going to close on this. What today is August 12th, 2022. I'm going to tell you that I believe by August 12th, 2042, Lexington will be recognized as the best middle-sized city in America, and it won't even be close.